I was kind of like, okay, your youth is over. Like, what is this now? And I actually remember telling a friend of mine about, I'm writing a book called The End of Youth, and my friend's, and at 40 at the time, my friend's like, yeah, no. And they're in their 70s, like, honey, you are still a whipper snapper. But these periods of, like, there's certain periods in your life when this is how you see the world, this is how you operate. And there are other periods in your life when you think, okay, how do I do things differently?
So speaking more specifically to the theme, to that theme in the book, there is this kind of looking back and what happens when we look back. Could you read to us from Fall?
Okay, so this is coming after summer, obviously. So summer is pimples and sour sweat and girls in bikinis at the city pool with their not quite ready to shave and acne-shouldered boyfriends putting lotion on their backs. Summer is half of everyone, half undressed, and all of them better than you. So after that, in fall, you cover up. Your mother no longer buys your clothes, so now you can cover up differently. One day in eighth grade, I wore a pair of midnight purple corduroy pants and a long sleeve t-shirt made of t-shirt material that had on it an applique of Saturn. The planet was almost the same dark purple as my pants. The rings around it were pink and chartreuse, and my older sister, a hippie by then, having bought it for me at a brand new store called a head shop. I was kicked out of school and not allowed back until I agreed to not break the dress code again. You want to appear like who you like. You don't want to look like you do. But the world around you changes. The time gets out of whack and you start looking wrong. Others around you are faster than you. You try to keep up, but you can't. You walk around awkward and dull and feeling fake and never know what to do with your stupid hands. You want to be like the ones you like and not have anything wrong with you and no one to think there is, but something is. Oh God, adolescence, right? And in many ways that's a serious passage, but I also have to just like remember like, oh my God, this is like late 60s, early 70s in suburban Texas, right? And my sister's like, she's a hippie and I go to a head shop and I was like, corduroy pants with a planet on it. It was like seventh grade or something. We're supposed to like wear, it's like, and it was like supposed to be like, you know, conservative Texas clothes. Like, I'm a hippie now. Just like, oh my God.
Well, I love the way the purple shirt kind of gives us this really palpable image of feeling outsider and feeling other. Did your writing life or your imagination sort of lend itself to navigating that self-consciousness of that age?
I was definitely one of those girls who kept a diary all the time, right? So it's just like, and also reading these passages makes you sound like I was like a complete weirdo. And I wasn't like a total weirdo. I had really good friends and, you know, smart kids and nice kids. And I wasn't like in a corner just, you know, babbling or something. So I had this nice life, right? But also at the same time, you're in junior high, like, ooh. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure a lot of it was around being what is a lesbian? And this is like late 60s, early 70s in Texas, right? I was like, what's that? And not knowing that stuff. Writing at that age, I was one of those kids who wrote a journal all the time. So I wrote poems and I wrote my feelings. And I think a lot of writers, particularly female writers, you know, start off as like girls who write diaries and journals. It's a great, you know, can be both a great helpful therapeutic thing and if you work on it, it can be a great, how do I practice style? How do I learn how to describe things? How do I, you know, make a sentence that has a kind of rhythm and whatever to it? So yeah, it was helpful to me.
So, and you move back into that you, right? When you're first describing, it's first person when you're talking about your purple shirt, but then you move into the, in, there's that voice where you, it's interior monologue and you use you, yeah?
Yeah, and so the first part of it is like summer is pimples, and then my mother and I buy me some clothes, and so it ends with the boys and the girls at the sun at the swimming pool, and then in the fall you cover up, and so it goes from the comfort of these kids comfortable with being who they are outside, and then covering up, and what are you covering up? I you don't really know, but wanting to wear the costume of a young hippie and covering up what I don't know. And so it shifts to that interior you.
If you're just tuning in, this is Between the Covers on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Can you read us a little more from Fall?
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Fall is also a season when someone can fall out of love. It's gradual and sad, or wild and thrashing, but always a beginning of an end. Was it something you did? A way you became disappointing? Or were you just stupid to think someone could love you? Did someone who once considered you novel get bored? Had they been mistaken to think you were worthy of love? Were you a fool to hope you maybe were? What's wrong with you? Or how could one not love the way one did? What did you mean when you said, I love you? Why did you tell the things you did? But someone falls out, so you must too, or act as if you have, like everything's fine, you're fine, as if you are no longer a child, or think like one, or think or hope you could prevent or undo what has changed. Inside you are broken and partly dead, but you can't die just yet. You have to pretend you're fine. You have, even you, your pride. Pride goeth before the fall, like Adam did, and Eve, and also, I think, in my pathetic, excusing, stupid way, the snake. They tried to know something they shouldn't know, do more than they knew how to do. They tried, despite all the things they were told, they wanted to know too much. It goeth before the rest of us too, us misconceived and miserable, miscarried, poor, aborted, lonely, self-devouring selves. You know you've been given a gift, a life, but what are you doing with it? How will you carry on when you've been so wrong? It's damp and decaying outside, a mess, and you're out in the mess of it, while inside you are hollow, dry. Your mouth is dry, it's getting tight. You do not want to think the way you think. You try to go back, undo the fall, forget the falling out. Perhaps the way you felt was wrong. Perhaps how you remember isn't right.
So again, this through line of shame that you use the you for, you don't get it right. It's this decentered, degendered, open you that fell out of love or was fallen out of love with. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to that way of querying like a rupture between two people?
Yeah, I mean, when something bad happens, right, you want to go back and say, what caused it, right? And you want to like find a guilty party and sue them, right? And you think, okay, I want to find out what caused this. I want to do something to prevent it happening again. If it's two people, you can't see inside the other one, right? And you really don't know what they thought. So you kind of try to speculate, right? Like, and you turn and bake it on yourself, like, I should never have, what was I doing thinking that person was in love with me? Why did I fall in love with that person? And so from trying to understand and explain a particular rupture, you expand out to think, try to understand how you understand things. And it's like the problem is bigger than just this break. It's like it's not just the break, it's like you don't understand things. Like, when did you, the problem is bigger than just this break, and trying to kind of expand out from that. And I think that happens to a lot of people. You get in kind of a cycle of thinking and you both can't get out of it, and at the same time you're going down deeper into it. And so I think that's that kind of interior circular, can't stop thinking of a certain way, looking at it a million different ways, is what is happening in that passage.
So related to that, this sort of brokenheartedness that you render so beautifully, it brings to mind another really strong dimension in the inquiries that you have, which is your faith. What sustains or what rescues us, what gives us hope, right? When things are broken. So this is a multi-part question. So how is your hope sitting with you currently?
You know, it's funny. I did an interview a couple of weeks ago, and somebody says, "How are you feeling?" I'm just like, "I have no hope. I have no hope."
And it was
like,
I think I read that.
It was 2 days after the Ukraine thing happened. I'm just like, okay, I have no hope. Like this is just, I can't wrap my head around it. But now a month later, it's like the Ukrainians, like, we have hope. We're going for it. Like, and I'm just like, it's a little bit like the George Floyd thing. You're just like, how can this happen? I said, horrible. And then the people who've been most profoundly attacked are like, yeah, we're not going to take this. And you just see this energy and this actual righteous, not just, you know, political American cancel culture self-righteousness, but actual rightness.
Yeah, actual courage.
Power and courage is like, okay, I'm going to die fighting. And so now I'm actually kind of heartened by this. And like, every day I read stories about, there was a story in the Seattle Times this morning about a guy who flew to Poland, you know, rented a van, and he's like driving people driving Ukrainians 2 days to go to new cities. And a friend of mine from college knew a guy who's teaching in Ukraine, and she like put this thing together, and you can just send $5 or $200 and he'll like, you know, feed the kids that are stuck in a school. And so my feeling utterly hopeless happens occasionally, and it's not as utter today. And again, you know, if I think of it in terms of seasonal stuff, it's like winter can be like really dark, and then spring comes again, you know, and it's like, and the book begins with like Persephone, like, oh my God, do I have to go back to spring again? But spring does come back, right? And the book throughout, and it also ends with, in the winter season, it's like one of the things that happens in winter is like Christians believe in the middle of darkness, this vulnerable kid, baby is born to a young unwed mother, and it's like in a outlying place of an exiled, you know, occupied country, something that small can bring light and goodness and mercy. And so, yeah, the story of Persephone, the story of Jesus, they are profoundly dark, but they also move to profound light. And those stories just mean the world to me. They just mean the world to me. But it's very, very hard to remember light when you're in darkness, right? And it's also, and there's also other kinds of darkness that you're just like, yeah, but still, like, still, really? Do people need to suffer that much? Like, really? Mm. Even if there's, like, really? Mm. And that's, you know, that's age-old cultural, age-old, and it's cross-culture. You know, why is suffering, you know? And I'm glad for all the people fighting against the Russians in Ukraine, but lots of people are dead. Lots of people have been raped. Lots of people have been completely traumatized. Lots of people will be homeless and have their lives completely, most completely ruined by this thing. So,
do you think your relationship with something as complex as the Catholic Church sort of helps you sort of hold these oppositional ways of seeing multiple truths across things?
Helps me, maybe, or maybe is part of, right? Because it's, yeah, kind of like, it's kind of like
diplomatic of, or
it's the same pattern, right? It's like, mm-hmm. I have a really good friend who's an expat from Britain, right? And she became an American citizen, and she's like the most furthest left, crazy. Not, she's not crazy, like really far left, like super. And I'm like, dude, what? Why did you become an American? She's like, well, because it has the best dream. And some people actually really can do things here. And so it's like this like horrible place that produces police brutality and George Floyd and women couldn't vote and blacks couldn't vote and genocide, all horrible stuff. And yet there's also possibilities, right? And, or like, you know, Donald Trump is like, he's not my president. Well, actually he was my president, right? He was my president. And I live in a country that half the people voted for Hillary and half the people, less than half. And so it's like that's our country. And for me, Catholicism, the Catholic Church is, well, like you see the windows behind me, it's like, it's a story of sacraments, and the central image of is the image of suffering that is overcome, right? The crucifix is the bloody and gory, but that's really suffering. And the religion, the Catholicism does not acknowledge suffering. It says there's something after suffering. It doesn't say it conquers death. It says it conquers the power of death. It is very complex, but also Catholicism offers the importance of the sacraments, right? It's like a holy meal, right? Or if you're sick, your body gets anointed. I've been to a lot of funerals lately, and the idea of having a funeral with a song and with ashes, right? And like, I mean, I don't know if you practice, you're a practicing Jew, but the idea of like a regular meal, right? Or sitting, you know, sitting, saying Kaddish. I mean, these old rituals that help us do stuff that we don't know how to do, right? And so it's very important to me.
Well, it sounds like part of what you, a quote by you, that art gives you a container for grief. It sounds like it's another example of this is a vessel with which to hold your grief.
Yeah, and Catholicism also holds hope, right? It holds hope. The idea that just the word resurrection, the word redemption, is like there is something after suffering. Mm-hmm. It's just like it's profound. Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about something you said earlier? It doesn't triumph over death, but it's over the power of death. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Can you say something about that?
Yeah, and it's just like, you know, it's like people die, right? Like she's kind of like, oh, it's a miracle, she died. It's like, but the idea of triumphing over the power of death, if death means everything is over, nothing mattered, you won't be remembered, you don't have a mark, it's like, no, that's not the thing. The power, it's like triumphing over that power and to sort of say someone's dead, but they will be honored and we regard that they will return to the cosmos, whether it's in the terms of, you know, fertilizing a tree or being in their granddaughter's memory or having a fellowship named after them at their high school. But the idea that life ends up, not down. Right? Mm-hmm. It ends with Jesus and dead people, you know, ascending and saying the good in our lives triumphs over the suffering, the pain in our lives, right? And I was a volunteer at a hospital for a number of years before the pandemic and visiting Catholic people there. And it was really amazing to me, some of these people that got like nothing, right? They're like in the hospital in really bad shape. But the importance for them of saying the prayers or taking communion or someone at their bedside having hope that they would see them again in some form, right? Rather than like, oh, your mom's dying, that's it, good luck. It's like your mother's dying, she's going to heaven and you can see her again. It's tremendous hope.
Well, and solace. It sounds like part of what you're saying is that the other side of the story offers comfort.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the face of not denying the brutality of the suffering.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. As far as sort of tying it back into your writing life, do you feel like the mysticism and ritual and detail of Catholicism has infused your work?
Well, I was received in the church like 10 years ago, so it hasn't been part of my whole life. But I started reading the Christian mystics when I was an undergraduate. And I've always been a big fan of like sacred music and visual art and all that kind of stuff. So I've been near the stories of suffering and redemption, right? And certainly, and I also listened for a long time to like High Church, Church of England stuff, and the prosody of a lot of the songs and spoken stuff there. And so in the sense of like the rhythm of a sentence or how a sentence goes, da-da, 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 da. Mm-hmm. And Jesus said, do you love me? Lord, you know that I love you. And Jesus said again, do you love me? And I said, Lord, you know that I do. And Jesus said the third time, do you love me? And he said, Lord, you know that I do. And just like that wonderful music. Rhythm and repetition and the music of it. And also the kind of, it's both really immediate and also really abstract, right? It's like, mm-hmm. This is food. Like, well, what is food that likes... It's, you know, feeds my corpuscles, but like, what is food that sustains me? Is it love? Is it knowledge? Is it sunshine? Mm-hmm. So just the physicality and the metaphor of it is just works really well for me.
That's such an interesting point about sort of what you're infused by is the rhythm of the sentences of the music, and that that has an impact when you're creating the music of the words of your and you're saying, so it sounds like that's been a big influence across time for you even before becoming Catholic.
Well, yeah, and also just you know, I studied a lot of English literature, and so I'm really and I'm Irish background, so the English the Great Britain ballad form, like a 3-4, 3-4 song verse, or iambic pentameter, or anapest rhythms, and so those English songs, and also American rhythms, right? Like Ernest Hemingway and Gertrude Stein, really monosyllabic, run-on sentences, and how they turn up or turn down. So, so my heritage as a English American person hearing language certainly predates my consciousness of anything, you know, Catholic, but very, very much, very, very strong sense of rhythm, of hearing. Yeah.
This is KBOO Portland. If you're just joining us, we're here on Between the Covers with Seattle's own Rebecca Brown.
Can we hear a little more?
Absolutely. In fall, you start to fall apart. In winter, you're already fallen. It happens again like it always does, which you should know by now, but you do not. Or you do know, but stupidly you pretend you don't. You try to sleep to get away from being alive and suffering. You try to sleep to undo what your passion turns you to. Your passion comes from somewhere both inside of you and outside, where you do not understand. Or if you do, or think you do, you fear it as much as you desire it. It is mysterious. Passion is when you're not just alive, not just breathing and eating and defecating and sleeping and not really caring whether you wake up or not. Passion is being alive a lot. You want to wake up. You want to want. You want to move toward and do something. Maybe you know a reason, maybe you don't, but nothing stops you. You want and desire and yearn toward a person or people or an idea or something. But passion, the word, derives from the Latin passio, which means to suffer. To want means you will suffer. To want is to know you might, but might not have. You'll have, but then you'll have not. You'll lose. To open the heart means it will break. You do not want to not want. You have to hope you will get through the bad, the worst, and that you will, or someone else, will come out living on the other side.
It really speaks to the point you were just making about, right, where faith sits as a, there's a moment after the death of things. And that, I love that piece as sort of bringing up the first part. If you have desire, you're going to have disappointment, or you're going to have an ending to it. But that, right, that piece about winter bringing the light afterward, it really,
right. Well, and also that whole thing about life and suffering. I mean, you know, one of the major tenets of Buddhism, which I studied for a while and sat in a sangha for years, one of the major tenets is just like life is suffering, and I can't quite go there. For me, it's like life is full of a lot of suffering, but you know, to grow is to change, is to lose something. And so it's kind of built into, and the Christian philosophy is like, it's built into free will, right? If we have free will, we're going to mess up. Right. If we don't have free will, we're all going to be like, did you see Dune, the movie Dune? Remember when the guy, like, he's like robot boy and he like turns people into robots? Remember that? No, they were robot thinkers. They go to see them in South America, and he's got his Jim Jones cult, and he like does his eyes. Everybody's like, we are obedient. Remember that part? Yeah, so like that's the alternative. No thanks.
Not to put too fine a point on it. Or robot.
KBOO Portland, listener-supported community radio. Stay tuned for Shocks of Sheba, up next after these headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 21 de abril del 2022. En medio de la pandemia, la Casa Blanca detalló hoy jueves un plan para aceptar hasta 100.000 refugiados ucranianos que huyen de la violencia, haciendo oficial una promesa anunciada el mes pasado. El programa se pondrá en marcha el lunes y permitirá a todos los ciudadanos estadounidenses presentar una solicitud a través del Departamento de Seguridad Nacional para patrocinar a refugiados ucranianos. Los solicitantes deben haber sido residentes de Ucrania a partir del 11 de febrero, haber pasado los controles